But the text today points us in a slightly different direction. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about this text, which has actually, some of us have been reading a book by a guy named Reza Aslan called Zealot. Reza, that's his first name, isn't it? I'm blocking it somehow. A book that has actually been in the news lately. Some of you may have seen an interview on Fox News with Reza Aslan that was sort of has become sort of notorious. Lots of people have looked at it online, mostly because of sort of the belligerence of the Fox interviewer, which has catapulted this book, Zealot, to the top of Amazon's seller list, and I think the New York Times bestseller list, which, in my understanding, is sort of a it's a little unfortunate. He is benefiting hugely from, the kind of publicity that people only dream about. Puts his book up in the center of people's awareness, controversy, and so he's selling millions of them. And the reason I bring this up is that the title, Zealot, is meant to identify Jesus with a number of, a member of a party, the Zealot Party, but also to identify Jesus as one of a number of first century figures, itinerant preachers, sort of schooled in the messianic hopes of Israel, incensed at Roman occupation, incensed at a priestly caste that was in cahoots with the Roman occupation and was completely unjust, in terms of their sense of fairness and especially economic justice. They were the ones that we hear sort of railed against so frequently in the prophets. And Reza Aslan, in his book Zealot, really wants to identify Jesus as one of these zealots who was wanted to throw off Roman occupation, wanted to establish himself as king, and was entirely prepared to use violence to accomplish these ends. Now, in his book, he makes a case for this, which I think is not particularly strong. There are a couple of reasons for this. It's very interesting. We all kind of struggle through books. I read it in a couple of days because it's interesting and it's historically vivid and it really tells quite a bit about first century Palestine and some of the tensions. And I still say if you want to get a feel for what first century Palestine was like, look at Egypt. Look at Syria. It's just, these places are just boiling over with tension, and the slightest little provocation causes it to erupt. He said the case that Aslan makes, I think, is weakened for a couple of reasons. One, he's what I would call a somewhat disingenuous scholar, which is to say, he starts off his book by saying the Gospels, as we receive them, the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, really tell us nothing about the historical Jesus. Because, he says, they are constructions of faith. They are works of theology. Listen to the Gospel of Jesus Christ. I want you to read this so that you also come to understand that he is the Christ. Well, that's out there. That's why the Gospels were written. They are constructions. They do bear the marks of their human authors. That doesn't make them untrue. It doesn't make them untrue. And Aslan is taking a position that is sort of pegged at one side of a scholarly debate, which is how much do the Gospels tell us about the historical Jesus? And most people say, they don't tell us everything. It's a mix of oral tradition and the gospel author's theology. But still, most scholars say, yeah, there's a real core of historical knowledge in there. Not always completely accessible, but it's there. Why I call Aslan disingenuous is that although he states they don't say anything about the historical Jesus, whenever it comes to making a point and he finds a passage in the Gospels that support his points, he's entirely happy to use it, as if it were just, you know, Rose reporting. You know, so he can't play both sides of the fence. And if you're going to, you've got to make that clear to your audience. And then the second thing, the second reason I think his book is kind of weakened is that really he can't even consider the possibility that anyone can rise above their historical context and see things with a unique perspective, see things that other people around you might not see. And so he basically says, since we know so little about the historical Jesus, and we do know from other accounts that there were itinerant preachers, there was a zealot party, there were people who wanted to be king, there were people who were committed to using violence, since that's what we know about the historical period, we're going to say that's true of Jesus too. That's a move, I think, that is unwarranted. And I think he just doesn't make the case very strongly. He's very, very selective in terms of what he uses to build his case that Jesus was, in fact, a violent revolutionary. It was all around him. And it's, again, Aslan's book is interesting just to see how the history from right around year 4 until year 70, resurrection or insurrections, acts of violence, suppressions, until finally in 80s, or you know, let's call in the common era, year 70, the Romans just finally got tired of this little irritating outpost and just laid waste to Jerusalem and just leveled it to the ground. Was Jesus the cause of this? I mean, it's actually kind of one of the things that Christianity has struggled against since the beginning. That Christians are the source of unrest. And they were kind of blamed for the fall of Rome, too. I think the case that Jesus was, in fact, a violent revolutionary is weak. I think the reality that he was a destabilizing presence is pretty clear. So the text today, what are we to make of the text? I come to bring not peace but division. Or the text in Matthew says, do you think I've come to bring peace? Not peace but a sword. So what do we make of that? At the simplest level, there is... Jesus was a controversial figure. You can sort of imagine that households, the gospel writer writing, you know, Luke was writing after the Christian movement had been established. He was writing after Jerusalem had been destroyed. He was writing with full view that actually families did get divided about this figure of Jesus. He had seen that happen, doubtless. I don't think that's the whole meaning of this text, however. One of the things I want to focus on and why Jesus might be considered a figure around whom violence or disruption might swirl. What was it that Jesus did that was destabilizing? And I think that destabilizing is the word that I want to put before us today. I mean, I think of things like the Cold War. Not really all that invested in the return of the Cold War, but the Cold War was a little more stable than the world right now. You know, two huge parties kind of facing off against each other kind of kept things in check. But once the Cold War disappears and those two sort of obvious centers of conflict, what do we have now? But multiple centers of conflict. We watched it happen in Yugoslavia and in the stands and in Syria now and Egypt now. Even, again, these convulsions occur when things are destabilized. The real destabilizing aspect of what Jesus requires of us, here's where I want to kind of plant really borrows a little bit more on, do you think I've come to bring peace? Not peace, but a sword. The sword, in psychological sort of use, is a way of talking about what is, again, a psychological term, differentiation. It's how we become individuals. And the really disruptive thing that Jesus did, I think, is that he asked those who were his companions and his hearers to become fully responsible individuals. And where the passage ends today, the next verse is what I think is one of the most radical things that Jesus ever said. He said to his hearers, why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? Why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? To get a feel for that, imagine saying that to your 7-year-old son and just letting it go with that. Why do you just judge for yourself? My job as a parent is done. Why do you judge for yourselves what is right? Well, of course, adult hearers are not children, but adult, citizens, how many institutions in our lives are sort of paternalistic? They don't want us to say, the institutions that guide our lives do not say to us, why do you judge for yourselves what is right? They say, do what I say or you'll be punished. The law says that. The church often says that. So many institutions say that. And for anyone to come into that situation and say, to just call them people, why don't you judge for yourselves what's right? That is just giving power away. Giving power away to everybody who hears. And when you start reading the teachings of Jesus in that light, over and over and over again, it's as if he's trying to activate that center of awareness within his hearers so that they can actually understand and be responsible for the freedom that is really theirs. The freedom to say, to say, well, this is my life, this is where I stand, this is what I see, and these are the decisions I'm going to make. Which is to say, a mature human being. And this notion of division, we almost always hear it as something toxic and polarizing and conflicted. But there's another way to hear division, which is to say, like in a marriage. A marriage, I think, really works best if you have two individuals there who can give clear account. This is what I see, this is what I experience, this is what I feel. How about you? How about you? Well, those are people that are divided, not in a toxic way, but in a way that makes relationship actually more possible. In my counseling years, I heard many couples come to me believing they needed to divorce, which is a form of separation. It's a form of division. But what they really needed was a little greater psychological differentiation. They needed to divide so that they could actually be in relationship with each other. And you've probably heard me say that the real sort of pinnacle of differentiation is in Jesus' teaching, love your enemies. If you're not differentiated, your enemy hurts you reactively. You hurt back. But if you're differentiated, your enemy hurts you, and you go, well, my enemy has hurt me. How do I want to respond? How do I want to respond? Do I want to retaliate? Do I want to get even? Do I want to extend compassion? All of those options are made possible only to the differentiated self. You have to be an individual to be in relationship to other individuals. You have to be an individual to claim your freedom to act as you see fit. Not determined by what the other person does to you. How do you want to act? Why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? Why do you not judge for yourselves what is right? That is Jesus. If you want a revolution that Jesus meant to start, that's it. That's it. A calling into question all of the paternalistic power structures of the world
and really wanting to raise up a body of mature individual human beings capable of acting out of their own freedom. He came not to bring a kind of peace that, in a sense, is no peace. I mean, there's another whole line of inquiry that we can pursue, but I'm not going to. It would just take us too far afield. But the peace that Jesus disrupted was not really a fully realized peace. It was a peace that was bought through compromise and keeping the lid on things, and generally a peace of one group that still sort of allowed itself to consider other groups to be enemies. And a lot of the cohesion of any group, and we still see it today, is built on having an enemy that they can all agree on. I mean, how much of the world runs that way? And so Jesus says, well, that's not much of a peace, and I'm going to take it away. But he didn't take it away with a dagger in his cloak, doing the work of murder and egocentric aspiration, I want to be king. But rather, in giving to people what is really, I think, our human birthright. Contra Augustine, it has not been obliterated. Like Mandela says, I'm kind of anticipating our course on Mandela. He says, people, they have to be taught to hate. And if they can be taught to hate, they can also be taught to love. Because the flame of human goodness can be hidden, but it can never be extinguished in human beings. Now, Augustine disagreed with that. I think Mandela is right. And I think that's what Jesus was talking to all the time. You are a child of God. And you can only